Jaws dropped all over the country last Thursday afternoon when a federal jury in Portland found all seven defendants not guilty in the first trial over last winter's takeover at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The verdict does not end the story of the takeover and the people who took part, not by a long shot. Let's get some perspective on what happened in court and what happens next. Amelia Templeton is with our sister operation at Oregon Public Broadcasting and joins us by phone. Amelia, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
You're welcome.
So anybody paying attention to a trial gets a sense of how it's going, and I'm just curious to know if anybody in your acquaintance or in the newsroom predicted the acquittal of all.
You know, I would say two people in our newsroom had a sense that maybe the prosecution's case wasn't going over very well, and that there were some real obstacles for them. I don't know that I can say that any of us predicted an acquittal across the board. I think all of us were expecting some kind of a split verdict where maybe a couple of the leadership or the people whom we had a lot more evidence against in the course of the trial, people like Ryan Bundy, maybe Ken Medenbach, would be convicted of something and where the rest would be acquitted.
Well, and Ken Medenbach was the one who was actually caught with a truck off of the wildlife refuge property in Burns, 30 miles away, wasn't he?
Yes, and amazingly, not only was Ken Medenbach acquitted of the conspiracy charge that he was facing, conspiracy to impede federal workers from doing their jobs, he was also acquitted of theft of government property for stealing that truck.
Wow.
And essentially, he said, you know, look, I fully intended to return the truck to the refuge. I was borrowing it. I got arrested before I had a chance to take it back. And the jury accepted that explanation.
Amelia, what was going on in the courtroom as the verdicts were read? I understand the judge read them. So was there a bit of an eruption as the first came through, or was there kind of a hush? Or, I mean, how would you characterize what was going on?
So the judge, Judge Anna Brown, throughout the trial has made a very serious effort to keep things orderly in what might otherwise be a pretty chaotic situation. She insisted that everybody be quiet as she read the verdicts and said, you know, that anybody who reacted would be ejected. And so it was dead silent, and it went from sort of normal courtroom silence, I think, to sort of stunned silence. People were just trying to wrap their heads around this as all, you know, it's one after another, these not guilty verdicts were read. And the first person whose name she read was Ammon Bundy. And so I think as soon as we heard Ammon Bundy not guilty, everybody realized this was going to be a big deal.
Well, and the calculations that you try to figure out as you're going along, I mean, it was the assumption that if Ammon Bundy was not guilty, that probably nobody else was either?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's a conspiracy charge. And so the charge is really all about an agreement between these people to impede federal workers. And so if the alleged leader of the conspiracy, if they weren't able to successfully convict him, it seemed impossible that anybody else would be convicted.
Amelia, once a trial is over, the jurors are not bound by any sort of court rulings, I assume, in this case, too. So they were free to talk about how they arrived at their decision. And I understand at least juror number four has gone public a bit about what his rationale was.
Yeah. So juror number four has said that this is not a sort of a broader statement of approval for what happened at the refuge, but that he felt narrowly like the prosecution failed to really provide the evidence to prove a critical piece of their case. So the core charge in this case was conspiracy to impede federal workers from doing their jobs. And the government essentially said, you know, they showed up at the refuge. They had posted guards at a watchtower. You know, there was a very clear sort of demonstration of force. They had schedules organizing shifts for armed guards, and that all of that shows this conspiracy to impede federal workers. The defense said, yes, they occupied the refuge, but their intent was not to impede federal workers. And that may have been a sort of side effect of what happened there, but in fact, their intent was to try to make this broader point about the Constitution and political protest. And because of the charge, it gave the defendants a real chance to speak at length about what they say they were doing and what their beliefs are and what was in their heads at the time. And that, you know, the juror essentially said the government failed to really prove the agreement to impede federal workers between this group of people.
I know this is a bit of a judgment call for any observer, but does it appear that this became more of a case about personalities and passions than about points of law?
You know, I don't know. I think there's a lot of really interesting questions about this verdict, and I think the only way to really know more is for more of the jurors to come forward and share how it was that they reached this decision. There's so many different factors sort of at play. You know, you had limits in some cases to the evidence that the government could present. So, for example, you know, they had a number of witnesses who were workers at the Malheur Refuge testifying, but the judge had ruled that those people were not allowed to testify to the fear that they felt because that, you know, was too subjective and too prejudicial in the case. And so you have factors like that at play, the sort of what evidence was ruled admissible, what evidence was ruled inadmissible. You have the fact that a number of people pled guilty prior to this trial, and so the defendants in this case were kind of an odd group of people, you know, Ammon Bundy and Ryan Bundy, and then, you know, a few others who weren't necessarily central figures in the occupation, or at least not until the very end of it. And so you were trying to allege a conspiracy between some people who maybe didn't even know each other that well, which I think might have been hard for the jury. But of course, you do have the personalities, and you have a pretty unusual defense strategy on the part of Ammon Bundy's attorney, where he kind of used the case periodically, I think, to challenge the validity of the legal system itself. And then you had a lot of people representing themselves, including, you know, Ryan Bundy, who I think walking into this, everybody assumed representing yourself is a very risky move and seldom pays off, but who managed to come across fairly well and fairly principled, I think, in court. And then on the other side, you've got the federal prosecutors. And what they have told us is essentially, look, this was an incredibly complex case, and we had to turn it around on a timeline that, you know, you almost never see a case like this have the events conclude in February and then go to trial on it in September. And just the sheer amount of evidence that they had to go through and produce for the defense, all of that work left them pretty exhausted by the time the trial took place. And they did, I think by the end of the trial, those federal prosecutors did kind of come across just a little bit worn out.
Amelia Templeton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting and one of the many people who covered the Bundy trial, in which all seven defendants were found not guilty last Thursday. So to the timeline, though, this is a really important part of this because it does seem speedy, particularly at the federal level. I mean, it's hard to get a state court to act on a case that where the circumstances were finished in the winter and you're already going to trial around the time that fall is going on. So at what level was the decision made to push for trial in Oregon at this point with these defendants?
So there were, I think, two different things going on. And the first was that very early on in the proceedings, Ammon Bundy and a few of the other defendants asserted their right to a speedy trial and insisted that they be tried as quickly as possible. And, I mean, at one point, I believe he was actually asking to be put on trial, you know, the next day or the next week. I mean, very, very quickly. And the judge essentially said, that's not plausible, but we will give you as speedy of a trial as possible. And interestingly, Bundy eventually fired, essentially, or stopped working with his original counsel and hired a new attorney, Marcus Mumford. And that attorney tried to actually delay the case and essentially said, I haven't had enough time to prepare. We need more time to get ready for this trial. I'm stepping in, you know, fresh. And at that point, Judge Anna Brown was unwilling to delay the trial because this group of defendants is also going to go on trial, or several of them will go on trial in Nevada in February. And so the other time pressure was really that the government is preparing these two cases in parallel, and they are planning for a Bunkerville trial in February, and they wanted to make sure they had enough time so that they could finish the trial in Oregon and give the defendants enough time to prepare their defense in the Nevada case.
And this is the case where people with guns held off the federal agents from rounding up the cattle, the Bundy cattle, that was not supposed to be grazing on federal land anymore. Now, that was a major point of contention at the close of this case, was that Marcus Mumford, I believe, was asking for Ammon Bundy to be freed, and the judge said no because he's got this other trial going. So what actually happened in court at that moment?
So after the verdicts were read, the judge began discussing the very practical question of what was going to happen with all these defendants who'd been acquitted. And most of them weren't in custody for the trial, but Ammon Bundy, Ryan Bundy, and David Fry, who was the last person arrested at the refuge, all have been in custody. So she had a sort of short conversation with David Fry's attorney where she said, you know, well, we could release him tonight, but I don't know if you're ready for that. And, you know, his attorney said, oh, yeah, we're plenty ready to have him out of jail. Go ahead and release him tonight. And then at the end, you know, everybody sort of thought that was it. And Ammon Bundy's attorney, Marcus Mumford, stood up and said, I expect we all agree that my client is free to go as well, which was kind of an astonishing assertion because there is a hold on Ammon Bundy and Ryan Bundy. The U.S. Marshals are planning to transfer them to Nevada, where they are going to be held in custody there until their trial there. You know, Mumford essentially said, he's been acquitted here in Oregon. You have no jurisdiction to keep him here. And the judge said, that's true, and I am not, you know, we aren't making any attempt to keep him on the charges he's now been acquitted of, but you and I both know he's still in the custody of the U.S. Marshals, and they're planning to transfer him to Nevada. And Mumford essentially refused to accept that fairly straightforward legal explanation. And I think, you know, you really have to understand kind of what comes next as a political protest on behalf of his client. But they got into a heated argument. The judge told him, Mr. Mumford, you need to not yell at me now or ever again. And shortly after that, the U.S. Marshals converged on him, and he sort of tried to sort of put some distance between himself and them. He kind of darted across the courtroom, and they just tackled him, and he began sort of rolling around on the floor, and they were asserting that he was resisting arrest. They were yelling, stop resisting, or you're going to be tased. And at that point, the judge ordered all of us out of the courtroom. And, you know, we'd already been fairly astonished by the verdict, but to have the trial end with the tasing of the defense attorney who had just won the acquittal of his client was pretty pretty astonishing.
Oh, absolutely. Amelia Templeton, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting, covering the Bundy trial. How much of this comes back to things like the judge's instructions to the jury? I mean, I wonder how tightly she might have confined what the jury was allowed to consider.
Well, I mean, I think jury instructions are certainly an incredibly important piece of this. And the juror who's spoken out has said, you know, the in our instructions, it was very clear the burden of proof the government had to meet in order to show that there was a conspiracy, and we don't think they met that. So based on what one juror has said, those jury instructions were a critical part of their decision. But, of course, that really gets back at the conspiracy charge and what you need in order to prove a conspiracy. I think it's hard to know, though, because we've really only heard from a pretty limited, you know, we've heard the most from a single juror. And I think until we've heard from more members of the jury about what swayed them or what they were thinking about, we're all really speculating about how they reached this decision.
Was that juror number four, the one who was instrumental in having another juror removed partway through deliberations and being replaced by an alternate?
Yes, that juror sent a note to the judge, and the note read, can a juror, a former employee of the Bureau of Land Management, who opens their remarks and deliberations by stating I'm very biased, be considered an impartial judge in this case? That note kind of upended everything that had been going on because they were the jury had been deliberating and they were essentially deadlocked. And judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys are not really supposed to know what's going on in the jury room. They're not supposed to discuss it. A juror's thought process is kind of a sacred thing that again, you know, that nobody really gets to investigate. But this allegation of bias, you know, the defendants also have a right to a fair trial. And so the judge ended up deciding that the only way to handle the situation, and I think to try to avoid a mistrial, was to dismiss juror number 11. But based on how everything has played out since then, it seems as if that juror was likely the holdout against the verdicts that we got.
Hmm. And so is there any timeline for the Bundy brothers transfer to Nevada?
You know, we're not sure exactly when that's going to happen.
All right. Amelia Templeton, good job on covering the trial, and thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
All right. Amelia Templeton is with Oregon Public Broadcasting.